From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Today is Friday, July 1st. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. A dramatic turn today in the sexual assault case of former IMF chief Dominic Strauss-Kahn. We'll hear the latest and get reaction in France. Also today, the story of a man who says he's constantly detained at the border while his name is checked against a terrorist watch list.
Sometimes it held me there for as much as 6 hours. Like 2-3 hours was just normal.
And why elections in Thailand could spell trouble.
Either outcome bodes ill for the future of stability in Thailand.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation. In its efforts to fight chronic disease and improve global health, the Medtronic Foundation supports patient-serving groups such as the International Foundation for Functional Gastrointestinal Disorders, which provides information and research about digestive disorders. More at iffgd.org. And by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at cargill.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Former International Monetary Fund chief Dominic Strauss-Kahn is no longer under house arrest. Today, a judge in New York released him without bail. Strauss-Kahn is still facing charges that he sexually assaulted a housekeeper in a luxury hotel suite in Manhattan. But today, prosecutors admitted in court they have concerns about the accuser's credibility. Though the woman still claims to have been assaulted, officials say she lied about other issues. One of the attorneys representing Strauss-Kahn, Benjamin Braffman, spoke outside the courtroom today.
At each appearance in the last 6 weeks, we asked you and we asked the world not to rush to judgment in this case. And now I think you can understand why.
That's one of Dominic Strauss-Kahn's attorneys, Benjamin Braffman, speaking today in New York. Vivian Walt is Time Magazine's Paris correspondent. This must be huge news in Paris. What is the reaction there?
It is, in the words of one socialist official, a thunderbolt in France. You cannot imagine the level of impact here of this news that the French woke up to this morning. There have been really non-stop coverage on all the French television networks throughout the day. Just as Dominic Strauss-Kahn's arrest on May 14th changed everything in France, it seems like everything has changed again.
I want to talk about that change, but first, from the very beginning in this case, this has to do with different cultural perceptions. Many French people felt that Dominic Strauss-Kahn had been treated unfairly by the U.S. legal system. Does this latest twist reaffirm those beliefs? What is the impact?
Yes, I mean, there certainly is a feeling among many French of vindication today. From the very start, they saw Dominic Strauss-Kahn as being a victim of a rush to judgment by the American justice system. People were frankly horrified by the scenes of him being led on the traditional New York perp walk. In the French eyes, it was an absolute kind of roasting in front of the press. And this has really kind of vindicated that belief of theirs that essentially things are not quite so clear-cut and that he might well have been sort of condemned as guilty before being proved innocent.
If ultimately Dominic Strauss-Kahn does walk away from this without being charged, and that is not the case right now, the prosecutor says he is going to continue to investigate this case, is there any way that he could possibly revive his political ambitions and even run for president?
Well, I think precedent is going to be hard for Dominic Strauss-Kahn. I mean, this has deeply, deeply shaken his image in France. There have been other accusations since then among French women who claim that he behaved extremely inappropriately towards them. There really is just too much that has happened in the last 6 weeks. However, Dominic Strauss-Kahn can certainly, if he is acquitted, come back to France as a major political force, possibly a cabinet minister if there is a socialist government next year. And other than that, simply the political kingmaker once again for the Socialist Party. He is far and away the most seasoned, most senior, most respected socialist in the country, or certainly was until 6 weeks ago. And his political career at this point after today just cannot be written off.
And beyond the political landscape, what about the questions of gender bias, of sexism, that not only were discussed here in the United States, but also in France immediately after the arrest and since?
Well, you know, Dominique Strauss-Kahn's arrest 6 weeks ago really set off an incredibly intense debate in France about women's position in society and the whole issue of flirting, of sexual innuendo and so on, which runs quite deep in this country. And for many years, people have simply turned a blind eye within the workplace and major corporations and at the highest levels of government. And Strauss-Kahn's arrest changed all of that. It's hard to overestimate what a huge impact it has had on the whole debate in France around these issues. And whether or not Dominique Strauss-Kahn is acquitted, found guilty, comes back home, this really has changed France. And that is not going to go away.
Time Magazine's Vivian Walt in Paris. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Our next story is also about a man who's run into trouble with the authorities, but that is where the similarities with the Strauss-Kahn case in New York end. The man in this case is called Shuaib Azizi. He lives in Southern California, and his name may or may not be similar to one that's on the U.S. government's terrorist watch list. Roxandra Guidi of the public media collaboration Fronteras has his story.
His story is straight out of Franz Kafka's The Castle, the story of a man who gets lost in a labyrinth of government bureaucracy to the point where it takes over his life and drives him mad. For Shuaib Azizi, it all started in 2007. Azizi is an Afghan-born U.S. citizen, a sharply dressed and upper-middle-class real estate broker from a San Diego suburb. He would regularly cross the border from San Diego to Tijuana to show properties to clients. One day, he was stopped and searched by Customs and Border Protection. Then it began happening over and over again.
Sometimes it hold me there for as much as 6 hours, then 5 hours, 4 hours, like 2-3 hours was just normal.
Azizi wasn't given a reason for why he was being stopped, nor what government agency he could turn to for answers. Soon after, he was being detained at airports, too.
They're going to search me, everything. I mean, my pockets, my body, and take everything out, my wallet, my belt, I mean, you name it. And then after that, you sit down and just sitting there waiting for hours and hours and hours till they get a clearance from Washington.
As the problem persisted, Azizi's relationship with his clients began to suffer. Eventually, a Customs and Border Protection agent hinted to Azizi that his name matched the name of a terrorist suspect in Afghanistan. In desperation, Azizi sent letters of complaint to local, state, and federal officials.
This is the... It was George W. Bush. This is Oscar Preciado, the director of the border.
Republican Congressman Brian Bilbray received one of Azizi's letters and began an inquiry. Brian Jones is a liaison with the Homeland Security Department for the congressman.
They sent a response back saying basically that they can't confirm or deny why he's being stopped, but they will look into it, and if so, they will make the necessary changes. After that, I never heard from him again.
But Azizi did. He received a letter from the Department of Homeland Security containing what's known as a Traveler Redress Inquiry Number, or TRIP, which he could show to officials next time he was stopped. His new TRIP number would allegedly take care of the problem. An interview request to the Department of Homeland Security's TRIP program went unanswered, but the FBI's Terrorist Screening Center, which manages the terror watch list, did respond to our questions. An official who asked to remain nameless said that, quote, 99% of the people who file a redress form who believe they're mistakenly on the terrorist watch list have no connection to the list at all. In other words, individuals like Azizi may not even be on a terror watch list to begin with.
You want it to be accurate and complete.
That's Timothy Healy, director of the Terrorist Screening Center, speaking to Voice of America in 2009.
It's a balancing act between private citizens and their concerns and the safety of the United States, and that's a balancing act that occurs every day.
Since 2005, the number of names on the watch list has expanded from 288,000 to 1 million in 2009, according to an audit by the Government Accountability Office. The ACLU calls the watch list bloated. Attorney Sean Reardon of the ACLU San Diego office says two main things are problematic with Azizi's case. If he's on the list, no one knows why, and there's no way to challenge it.
The government's vision may be completely unreasonable in that case, but yet there's very little way to even gather information about what's happening, let alone to try to frontally attack any errors that the government might be making.
Security consultants say the terror watch list is riddled with mistakes, but they say it could be better if it were streamlined and shared between more government agencies like France and Britain do. As far as Azizi goes, he recently changed his name from Shuaib Mohammed Azizi to just Shuaib Azizi, but that hasn't helped. One recent positive development is that Azizi is being stopped less at the border. Congressman Brian Bilbray's office is taking credit for the change. But in the absence of a transparent process, the real reason is a mystery. For The World, I'm Bruxandra Guidi in San Diego.
There were huge anti-government protests in Syria today. In fact, they were said to be some of the biggest demonstrations yet against the Syrian regime. Activists say hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets around the country to demand that President Bashar al-Assad step down. The government responded with violence. Several people were reportedly killed. Some of the protests in Syria are being coordinated by activists using Facebook. And the protesters are also using social media to come up with names for their demonstrations. Today, in fact, the protests were dubbed Depart Friday. Wael Tamimi is a Syrian broadcast journalist with the BBC's Arabic service. What does Depart Friday mean?
Actually, it means a command for Bashar al-Assad, President Assad, that you have to leave now. The protesters across Syria, as you have just said, hundreds of thousands, they are saying the word depart, leave. Bashar Assad, you have to go now.
Can you give us some of the names of previous Friday protests and whether or not they all carry a message like that?
Most of them were carrying messages. Last Friday, it was the Friday of the fall of legitimacy. It holds very big meaning that this regime has no legitimacy whatsoever and the regime got to go, got to fall. So they name it the fall of legitimacy. And as what happened today, also, hundreds of thousands took to the streets of Syrian cities. The Friday before, they named it a prominent Alawite rebellion against the French occupation in Syria. You know that President Assad is from Alawite minority, is sect of Shia. They want to give message to the rest of the Syrian people that it's not a Sunni Muslim uprising against minorities. So they wanted to name it by the name of this guy in a clear show of solidarity and national unity. So they are always choosing symbolic names, if you want.
So the names are supposed to be symbolic, and yeah, they are being voted on by anyone who goes to this particular Facebook site. And we're going to make a link, in fact, on our website, theworld.org. Who's doing the voting, and how does it work?
In the early days or month of the uprising, the name was chosen by the admins of the Syrian Revolution page on Facebook. So the people did not used to vote on the name of the Friday. But actually, they complained to the admin. They told him, we want a democratic Syria, so you have to give us the chance to vote for the name of the Friday. And actually, the admins of these pages responded positively, and they started to put names on their pages, maybe on Monday and Tuesday of each week, and then led the people to vote on it. Everyone, you can vote for the name, everyone can vote for it, and then the result will be announced on Wednesday evening, and then the name will be adopted on Friday.
What does this represent in terms of the larger picture of how social media is still making an impact? To what extent is it?
Actually, I can easily say without social media networks, there would be no uprising in Syria. The Facebook, YouTube, more than Twitter actually, because Twitter is not very popular in Syria. Facebook and YouTube are the major factors of the uprising in Syria. Yesterday, there were many protests in Aleppo, Syria's second largest city. It was totally organized and coordinated by the Syrian Revolution page on Facebook. The Syrian regime is preventing any independent media from going inside Syria. And the only way to see the pictures of the protest and the protesters is through YouTube and Facebook.
All right. We're going to make a link once again to the activist Facebook page. It's in Arabic. We're going to make a link anyway at theworld.org. This is where Syrians are voting on the Friday protest names. Wael Tamimi of the BBC's Arabic service in London. Very nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating Project 6, the worldwide volunteer effort by Medtronic employees during the month of June. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Women in Saudi Arabia have not given up their campaign to get behind the wheel, but the fiercely conservative Saudi government isn't giving them a green light. This week, five Saudi Arabian women were arrested for driving in the coastal city of Jeddah. Saudi activists are calling the arrests an escalation on the part of authorities. Iman Al-Nafjan authors the blog Saudi Women. She's in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Iman, the women who were arrested have now been released, but I wonder if the arrests themselves have a chilling effect on other women who might want to take to the roads.
The risk has always been there. Women have never reached their destination when they drive. They're arrested, taken to the police station, and made to sign a pledge that they will not drive again, and their male guardians are also brought in and made to sign the same pledge.
Is it clear how many women are out there driving or have tried driving in the past?
A day has gone by since June 17th. Without at least two, three women driving and reporting it on Twitter or posting a video.
Two or three women, I mean, I guess that's kind of a record, but it's, you know, really, is it significant in terms of all of Saudi Arabia?
The number of women who do know how to drive are very few because we do not have women driving schools. One estimate says that there are only 45,000 across the country. So out of 45,000, how many of these women want to make this kind of statement? Not that many. And it's risky. You have to keep in mind when you go out driving that you might spend the night in jail.
Well, as is the case with many things we're talking about on the program today, in fact, the campaign has gone to social media, and we know that there are women and potential women drivers in Saudi Arabia who are going on Twitter, and there's a particular hashtag, Women2Drive, the number 2Drive, where you can see posts aiming to connect Saudi women who already drive or know how to drive with Saudi women who want to learn how to drive. They say that these requests are going to be handled confidentially. Do we know if this is working?
And a lot of these women are beginning to be fearful because it has become such a political issue. I think it's great that there is this program, but I don't think it's too long-term to actually give us any real results. I think that we should be working towards to actually have the government establish driving schools for women.
The government established
women sneaking around and teaching each other.
Having the government establish driving schools for women. I understand there is also another Twitter post today saying, women, if you're going on vacation, enroll in a driving school in your destination. Do you, as you kind of look ahead to see where all of this is going, can you imagine a time, years from now maybe, when thousands of women drivers in Saudi Arabia are going to be taking to the roads?
Yes, I can. I've seen the same reaction to satellite dishes. I've seen the same reaction to the internet. I've seen the same reaction to cell phones. When cell phones first came to Saudi Arabia, you had to get a special license, and they were only allowed for men, and now everybody has one.
All right. Thank you very much. Look forward to talking to you more to see how the campaign among Saudi women to start driving is going. Iman Al-Nafjan authors the blog Saudi Women. She spoke to us from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. In fact, our listeners can see videos of Saudi women on the road at our website, theworld.org. We'll make a link to your blog as well, Iman. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Unlike their counterparts in Saudi Arabia, women in Italy are free to drive cars without fear of prosecution, but they do face other kinds of gender bias. Witness this news item. A small engineering company near Milan recently let go almost half its workforce, and all of those laid off were women. John Hooper is covering the story in the Guardian newspaper. What reason did the business owner give for laying off only women?
They've not been answering their telephone, but the local union representatives have quoted them as having told a local employers association that the reason why they laid off only women was so that the women could stay at home and mind the children. They reportedly added that the women, in any case, were earning second incomes.
And is that the case? And does it matter to the women who were laid off and their union? What's their response?
Well, it certainly doesn't matter to the union. They say that this is just a gross example of discrimination. It is also highly questionable. The women are between the ages of 30 and 40, and according to the union, in many cases, they are the main breadwinner of their family.
What we're talking about here, for some perspective, is a small family-owned company. This is about 30 workers, 12 of whom were men, 18 women before 13 of the women were laid off. It's a place that makes electric fans and blowers for air conditioning, refrigeration, and heating equipment, as you have reported. Is it a reflection of a more widespread attitude toward women in the workforce in Italy, even on the corporate and government levels, or do you think this is more of a one-off?
Well, sadly, I think Italy has slipped behind the rest of Western Europe in many respects where gender equality is concerned, and nowhere more so than in the field of labor. Less than half of women in Italy have a job, and Italy is now on that score in terms of its female workforce, the country in Europe which is least advanced, apart from only Malta, another very Catholic country by tradition.
That's John Hooper of the Guardian newspaper. To get an additional perspective on why Italy appears to have fallen so far behind when it comes to women's rights, we spoke with Lorella Zanardo. She's a writer and a documentarian. Her 2010 film, Women's Bodies, deals with negative stereotypes about women in Italy.
Responsible of these were also the media, which portrayed for a long time women like sexual objects on TV. And I think that these didn't help the Italian society to improve their mentality. So now we are witnessing a sort of going back to the 60s or the 50s. But the good news is that women are not accepting all this, and in fact the women workers of this small company are fighting in order to have their work back, and a lot of women are supporting them. But it's sad to say that their colleagues, their male colleagues, are not helping them, but women, yes.
The men,
there is a solidarity among women in this moment in Italy.
The male colleagues aren't helping, but the women are. In general society,
yeah.
Are men with the women on this or not?
No, they are not. They are not, and we have to be prepared to fight against this mentality. Patriarchal society means that it's difficult for Italian men to accept that women have the same rights than men. But good news is that I'm visiting a lot of schools in order to bring to students media education programs, in order to be prepared to watch television with a critical eye. And I have to say that younger men are much more modern, are much more European, are much more open to women issues. So I think that the solution is a sort of recipe is to work with students, young men aged 14 to 18, in order to have a future generation more modern and less patriarchal.
All right. Thank you very much, Lorella Zanardo, women's rights activist in Italy, speaking about the debate over the status of Italian women. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Got some good summertime music coming up on PRI. I'm Lisa Mullen. Still ahead, the state of Georgia gets tough on illegal immigrants. One farmer there is losing money as employees leave to avoid a new law.
A fake ID, first-time offense, can be up to 10 years and a $100,000 fine. I mean, that's like a felony. A felony for using a fake ID to get a job, to support your family.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Solnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Parts of a tough new immigration law went into effect today in Georgia. It's the latest instance of a U.S. state seeking to make it harder for illegal immigrants to live and work within its borders. Earlier this week, a federal judge blocked some of the law's provisions, but other parts of it are now being enforced, such as the one that makes it a felony to use false information when you're applying for a job. The new law is already affecting Georgia industries that rely on undocumented workers. Shamil Ahmad, a member station WABE in Atlanta, sent us this report from a blackberry farm in South Georgia.
I picked the pretty ones. Big ones.
It's the tail end of blackberry season in South Georgia. Isabel Rojas is out in the heat with an American flag scarf covering her head. She's bending and plucking through the blackberry vines. She's trying to get plump, deep purple berries. And today she says there aren't as many workers as there usually are.
Right now, not too many. We used to be down here about 75, and right now we're only 40.
Rojas says some migrant workers who came from Florida left after just one day. They were scared, she says, of the new Georgia law. But Rojas, who herself is undocumented, plans on staying in the state even with the new law.
I got all my babies here. They grew up. They marry. I got 5 grandbabies. Here is my life.
Georgia's Governor Nathan Deal signed House Bill 87 into law right when the blackberries were ready to be harvested. At the bill signing in mid-May, Deal said his aim was to deal with an issue being ignored by the federal government and to help his state during tough economic times.
With an illegal population that is estimated to be almost 500,000, the collective financial cost to our educational, health care, and correctional infrastructure is in the billions.
But critics of the bill point out that undocumented workers help Georgia businesses bring in billions of dollars. And the new law is already hurting them. Take the state's $69 billion agriculture industry. Brian Toler is the president of the Georgia Agribusiness Council. He opposed the bill and says it's hurt his industry in the past 6 weeks.
So what we've seen is about a 30% loss in that labor force. And so we're looking at about a $250 to $300 million loss potentially.
Field I'm going to take you to now, you're going to see that there's ripe berries are on the ground, and this is because they couldn't get picked. If we'd had more workers, naturally we would have been able to get those picked. So.
Gary Polk is one of the owners of the family-run farm where Rojas picks blackberries. He says he's lost about $200,000 this blackberry season, mainly because of Georgia's new law. But what bothers Polk more than his financial loss is how punitive the law is.
Fake ID is first-time offense, can be up to 10 years and $100,000 fine. I mean, that's like a felony. A felony for using a fake ID to get a job, to support your family.
And what drove many workers to not come to Polk's fields this blackberry season is a fear that police would have increased power in immigration matters. Javier Guerrero, a contractor who recruits workers for the farm, had a really hard time finding any migrant workers this year. Guerrero even went to Florida to try and recruit.
And I went like 3-4 different places over there, and I don't bring not even one. A few called me when they find out about how the law was going to be here. They get scared, they don't come.
Polk is glad that a federal judge temporarily blocked 2 key provisions of the Georgia law this week, and he hopes the hold will keep workers on his fields. But it may be too little too late for him.
Well, I think the damage, in my opinion, has been done because there's so much hearsay. You know, all this other that's happened was before the law ever became effective anyway.
The blackberry harvesting season is almost over. Now it's on to muscadine grapes. Polk's curious to see how many workers he'll get to pick them later this summer. The grapes are his main crop. For The World, I'm Shamil Ahmed in Atlanta, Georgia.
For today's GeoQuiz, think tiny. We're looking for one of the smallest independent states in the world. Actually, it's the second smallest after Vatican City. That independent state is located within the city of Rome. The one we want you to name today is nestled on the famous Côte d'Azur, also known as the French Riviera. Sure, this is a tiny place, but it attracts a lot of wealth.
We're not just talking about its casinos. Here's your biggest clue now. This small principality is decked out for today's royal wedding, or as they call it there, a princely wedding. The guest list for the festivities includes the kings of Spain, Sweden, Lesotho, and Belgium, the presidents of France, Iceland, Ireland, Lebanon, Malta, Germany, and Hungary, plus opera singers, fashion models, and race car drivers. Where are all these glitterati gathered? The answer, and more on those nuptials, coming up. The two main political parties in Thailand held rallies today. They're getting ready for key elections on Sunday. Thailand is an important U.S. ally in Southeast Asia. It gets millions of dollars in American military aid and anti-terror training every year. It's also a democracy at a crossroads. This will be the first election since massive anti-government protests rocked the capital, Bangkok, for 3 months last year. The country remains deeply divided, and there's concern that the vote on Sunday could spark more turmoil. Erwin Loy sent us this report from Thailand.
You're listening to one of Thailand's newest radio stations. It plays music like this, soaked in politics. This particular song is critical of the government, blaming authorities for stifling freedom of speech. It's a rallying cry of the opposition red shirt movement, and this suburb on the edge of Chiang Mai in northern Thailand is a heartland of support for the red shirts. Supon Phumun Sharun is an official with the United Front for Democracy Against Dictatorship, or UDD, as the red shirts are officially known. He says the radio station, which hit the airwaves mid-June, is the ideal way to spread the message. Every household has a radio, he says. It's the best way to reach out to the people and promote the idea of democracy. For many red shirts here, democracy comes in the form of loyalty to one man, the former prime minister and wildly wealthy businessman, Thaksin Shinawat.
Thaksin, there is no neutrality to the name Thaksin. You either love the man or you hate him in Thailand.
Paul Chambers is the director of research at the Southeast Asian Institute of Global Studies at Chiang Mai's Payap University.
Thaksin Shinawat was a very popular populist prime minister who promised to improve the lot of the poor. Indeed, when he was elected, he did initiate policies to improve the quality of life of poor people, urban and rural.
Those policies included instituting universal health care and handing out subsidies to farmers, all of which helped cut poverty in half within 4 years. That endeared him to the rural poor, especially in the populous northeast and here in the north. This is also where Thaksin was born. But as strong as the support is for Thaksin here, so is the level of distrust for him elsewhere. Some of Thaksin's reforms, including appointing key allies to the military, angered the country's elite, and he was deposed in 2006 by Thailand's powerful military. Thaksin now lives in exile after being convicted on corruption charges. Even though Thaksin is out of Thailand, he's still front and center in the upcoming election. After all, Thaksin's sister, Yingluck Shinawat, is running for prime minister with the Pua Thai Party, the party backed by the red shirts. In the Thai media, Yingluck has preached national reconciliation, both for her brother and for last year's government crackdown on the red shirt protests that left more than 90 people dead. But the seeds of the red shirt movement itself grew from their frustrations over Thaksin's ouster. In a campaign stop here in red shirt territory, the current Prime Minister, Abhisit Wajajiwa, and his Democrat Party steer clear of the topic of last year's bloody crackdown. Duen Dem Duen Na Chiang Mai, a local Democrat candidate, says she wants to look past the protests.
But I don't think this should be the main issue for the people of Thailand. It should be other things too, such as economy right now. Who can run the country well to solve, you know, our economy problem?
But that's a hard sell for diehard red shirt supporters. They worry their favorite Pua Thai Party could win the most number of seats this weekend, but still be denied the prime minister's seat. That's because of the wheeling and dealing required under this parliamentary system. If that happens, some red shirt leaders say they'll return to the streets in greater numbers. On the other hand, if the Pua Thai Party does take office, it's expected to push to give Thaksin amnesty. That could create havoc with the forces opposed to him, and anti-Thaksin demonstrators, known as Yellow Shirts, have also been quick to take to the streets in the past. In a country where politics are literally worn on your sleeve, observers say the July 3rd election could well mark the beginning of a long period of turmoil. Paiup University professor Paul Chambers.
Either outcome, a pro-Thaksin government or a anti-Thaksin government, bodes ill for the future of stability in Thailand. And the fact of the matter is, if losers of the election are unable to accept the election results and are willing to fight in the streets, then that bodes ill for the future of Thai democracy. And so we are in a dark, dark tunnel until Thais can really accept some sort of unity in their country.
Recent polling suggests the red shirt backed Pua Thai Party has a lead going into the election. Whether it will be enough to lead the country after July 3rd remains to be seen. For The World, this is Erwin Loi in Chiang Mai, Thailand.
We have a slideshow from the Thai campaign trail. It's at theworld.org. A small principality in Europe is holding a really big party today and tomorrow. We're talking about Monaco. The answer to our geo quiz today, Prince Albert of Monaco got married in a civil ceremony today. The new princess, Charlene Wittstock, a former Olympic swimmer from South Africa. A religious ceremony attended by royalty and celebrities from all around the globe is planned for tomorrow. In the meantime, Monaco is all abuzz. Reporter Claire Lathbury is covering the giant party for the Riviera Times newspaper in Monaco.
Today we've just had the civil marriage, which was in the throne room in the palace. So they signed on the dotted line at 5:15. So Charlene now becomes Her Serene Highness Princess Charlene of Monaco. And at the moment they're having an enormous sort of cocktail party for all the Monegas up on the rocks. So there's a sea of people and flags and delicious food and champagne for the Monegas up there. And then this evening there's going to be a big concert with Jean-Michel Jarre, which is for everybody. It's free for everybody. And then tomorrow is the religious ceremony, and we've got people like Nicolas Sarkozy and half a dozen kings, including the King of Lesotho and Prince Edward and the Countess of Wessex, flying in for the religious ceremony, followed by dinner and a ball in the beautiful, beautiful Salle Garnier Opera House, and then a big fireworks display.
Paint a picture for us. What does Monaco look like right now?
Well, right now it's looking great because they've been doing a lot of work to spruce up all the buildings. There's flags everywhere, lots and lots of South African flags. It's a lovely sunny day with a bit of a breeze, but still very hot. But it's funny because today I think it's been fairly quiet before the storm. I think tomorrow will be the day. I live in Fontvieille and we have the helicopter pad fairly near us. So I think tomorrow's going to be a very busy day on the helicopters as they bring everybody in.
Now, not to take away from the flowers and the pomp and the flags, but it was said of the bride, Charlene Wittstock, that she started to get cold feet not too long ago and even bought a one-way ticket back to South Africa. Any proof of that?
None at all. I mean, just like the rest of the world, there's a lot of rumors and, you know, people have heard this, but I know no more than you do from looking at the internet.
Worth a mention here that there is no king of Monaco. Prince Albert, whose father was Prince Rainier, that was Grace Kelly's husband, as we know him here. Prince Albert is in charge of Monaco. What kind of a leader is he? Is he somebody who has good popularity there?
Oh, he's tremendously popular, and he's very accessible and very approachable. But I think some people worry that he's a little bit too approachable and maybe hasn't quite got the steel that his father had. Because, you know, his father took Monaco through some very difficult times and came through. And I think they wonder whether Albert is just a little bit too nice.
So it sounds like it's such a spectacle and a beautiful landmark event. What does it mean for the people of Monaco that this man who at one point was considered something of a playboy, that he's finally tying the knot?
Well, I think it means a lot because, they are really hoping that there will be an heir to the princely throne. The succession has to go through the male line, or it did have to. I mean, it has changed. But nevertheless, I think, you know, the tradition is very strong here, and I think they really want that succession.
Although he has two children, he hasn't been married before, but do they not count as heirs?
No, they don't. They will have, from what I understand, if he dies and his personal estate is divided up. They have a right to that, but they are not eligible, as illegitimate, they can't be heir to the throne.
Claire Lathbury of the Riviera Times speaking to us from Monaco, the answer to our GeoQuiz and the site of the wedding of Prince Albert and South Africa's Charlene Whitstock today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we've got some royal winners in our GeoQuiz today, our GeoQuiz texting game. They include Ashley in Bellingham, Washington, Letitia in Ogden, Utah, and Sonia in Lafayette, Colorado. If you haven't gotten hitched yet with our GeoQuiz texting game, do so now. Just text GeoQuiz, one word, GeoQuiz, to 69866. Our global hits on the way. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Now, before we let you go out and enjoy this 4th of July weekend, we'd like to turn to music critic and world contributor Tom Schnabel, who's going to give you a few suggestions for musical backdrops to your summer of 2011. Tom and I, in fact, are both going to send you off with a couple of our favorite music picks. Tom, why don't you go first?
Okay, thanks, Lisa. My first pick is a group with an odd name, Los Chicharrones. Chicharrones is fried pork belly. It's a tasty and rather unhealthy thing. These guys are both DJs from Denmark and from Dominican Republic, but they're also mixing in some Malian singers. They put together a nice album. It's very, very organic. It doesn't sound like just DJs and some samples. It sounds very, very good. So they're called Los Chicharrones, and the piece that I would like to turn to is called Saramba's Song. Saramba is the name of the Malian singer that they use on this particular track. That was Saramba's Song. It featured a Malian vocalist named Saramba Koyate from this new album by these DJs from Denmark and from Dominican Republic, Los Chicharrones.
I got to say, listening to that, you can picture yourself having this as the backdrop to a long summer drive. It kind of bespeaks hot weather.
Absolutely. This will make for a nice ride.
A very different kind of sound now comes from a Spanish musician whose summer tour schedule has already taken him here to the United States. We're betting he's going to be back circling this way, though. Tom Schnabel, I bet you've already seen him, Jordi Savall.
I haven't seen him, but I've listened to a lot of his records, and he is truly wonderful.
This man is a tour de force, as you know. He's a musician, a musicologist. He's a champion of early music. The CD that came to my attention is an album that came out just last year, and this is called The Celtic Viol II, viol for viola da gamba, which is Jordi Savall's instrument. Right now, we're hearing a little bit of it. He's playing the treble viol. And the reason I chose this track is because you're going to hear clearly the other instruments on the album. The psaltery, this ancient instrument that you can hold, has a soundboard and strings that you pluck. And the other key instrument that's just about to come up here, the fantastic Irish drum known as the bodhrán. This man has done so much, Jordi Savall has, bringing together music from different time periods and different cultures and making them sound modern and fresh and, I think, a really good summer listen. What's next for you, Tom Schnabel?
Well, the next one actually is connected. You know, the way music travels around, the Phoenicians went past Spain and up into Ireland and the British Isles and then back down again. So there's a connection that the Celtic music of Spain is very much a part of Jordi Savall. And it's also a part of Amina Alawi's music. She is a classically trained Moroccan singer. But some of her songs go back to the time of the Crusades. She sings troubadour songs in medieval French. She is an incredible singer, and she has a new album out, which is called Arco Iris, or Rainbow. She has a number of wonderful musicians with her. She has a flamenco guitarist. She has a mandolin player, and the new album is absolutely wonderful. We'll hear a track called Florida Nieve, Amina Alawi. She has an amazing voice. Again, that's Amina Alawi. Tom Schnabel, I have a female vocalist as well, who's one of my picks. This is a woman who we're interviewing later on in July. She has her second American release that's coming out in July, in fact. Her name is Imelda May. May sound a little bit like Grease, would you say? Surf guitar.
Like surf guitar. Or rockabilly. This is Johnny
Yeah,
Get
something
a
like
boom.
That. Yeah.
He got me with the hook, those big bass notes, thunder on my chest, stuck in my throat, pulling me down, like a rumble in the ground, crawls up from the depths, with a deep down sound. Johnny got a boom boom, Johnny got a bam.
That's her husband, Daryl Hamm, on guitar there. Imelda May, originally from Dublin, Ireland, touring all throughout Europe, and she's been touring in the United States with Jeff Beck as well. And we look forward to presenting her interview later on in July.
She doesn't sound Irish at all to me.
No, she doesn't. Although when she talks, I promise you, she'll sound extremely Irish.
I'll be listening.
Yeah, she's great. Okay, Tom, why don't you wrap it up for us?
Well, my final summer pick is this great new album put together by Joaquin Joe Clausel. It's called Africa Caribe. He is a New York DJ, and what he does here is reworks classic music from the Fania Records catalog. A big catalog, Fania Records put salsa on the map. It had definitely a lot of attitude, very strong stuff, and Joe Clausel even steps it up a ramp and makes it a little bit better. And I think only the purists who only like the original versions wouldn't like this great new record called Africa Caribe.
All right. right, Tom, you and I have had our say. We're inviting our listeners now to tell us what new music they're going to be bringing to the beach this summertime. They can let us know at theworld.org. Tom Schnabel, so nice to have you with us, and happy 4th of July to you.
Same to you, Lisa.
Thanks. Tom Schnabel, music programmer at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. We're going to have a list of all of our summer music picks at theworld.org, and don't forget again, you can add your own summer music choices to the list. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. Eric Goldberg composed the world's theme music. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the holiday weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio Boston. The World is supported in part by the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin. Information at nsf.gov. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming. PRI Program Fund contributors include the Ford Foundation and Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees.
PRI, Public Radio International.